Chapter 20, Nature Cure Clinic. Dr. Mehta's Nature Cure Clinic and Sanatorium occupied a spacious compound in a tree-shaded avenue immediately behind the Pune railway station. It consisted of two buildings, one much larger than the other. The larger of the buildings was a tiled, barn-like structure consisting of a central hall surrounded by 8 or 10 suites of small rooms, hall and rooms alike being paved with black flagstones. The smaller building, which must once have been servants' quarters, was situated in a corner of the compound on the same side as the front entrance of the larger building. It occupied an important place in the history of India, or at least in the history of the independence movement, Mahatma Gandhi having stayed there a number of times in the 40s with his entourage and taken treatment from Dr. Mehta, who was his personal naturopathic physician and the manager of two of his 3 21-day fasts. The smaller building was therefore called Bapu Cottage in his memory, Bapu or Father being the name by which the Mahatma was known to his more intimate associates. The room where he had lived and worked was kept much as it had been in his day, and his bed, writing table and spinning wheel could still be seen. Flush with the top of the rear wall of the compound was the stone platform from which he was wont to address the people who had gathered in the adjacent railway compound for his evening prayer meeting. On my arrival at the clinic one day towards the end of January, I could not help noticing that the larger of the two buildings had a shabby, neglected look, and that the paths surrounding the garden between it and the rear wall were overgrown with weeds. Though the occasional patient still convalesced there, the clinic had been inoperative for 2 or 3 years, Dr. Mehta himself having not so much as visited the place during that period, despite the fact that his wife and his 2 small children were living at Bapu Cottage. But recently things had changed. God had spoken. Guidance had come to the effect that a branch of the Society of Servants of God should be established in Pune at the Nature Cure Clinic, that the Union Government Minister of Planning, Sri Gunzaranal Nanda, a former patient of Dr. Mehta's, should be invited to address the inaugural meeting, which was to be on a grand scale, and that Bhikshu Sangharakshita should be invited to preside. Even though I did not, indeed as a Buddhist could not, believe that the guidance received by Dr. Mehta in meditation came from God, though I was willing to concede it might come from a source higher than his own conscious mind, the knowledge that I was the object of what the servants of God regarded as nothing less than the personal attention of the Almighty gave me a peculiar sensation, the more especially as I also knew that the question of whether or not I would accept an invitation that had actually come for me in guidance was one of intense interest and concern to Sundri and the other members of the inner circle. In the end, having consulted with Dinu Dubash, who was of the opinion that society could do with a good dose of Buddhism, I decided to accept. My decision was in no way determined by the fact that the invitation might have come from a higher source. The reason for my acceptance was that I was glad of an opportunity to visit Pune and possibly make contact with the Buddhists there, of whom I had heard there was a considerable number. Thus, a day towards the end of January saw me arriving in Pune by Deccan Queen, being met at the station by Miss Dubash, and by her being conducted to the Nature Cure Clinic in Taddiwala Road. Dr. Mehta was already there, having arrived a few days earlier, together with members of the inner circle, and I was soon accommodated in a suite of rooms across the hall from his own. The inaugural meeting of the Society's Pune branch was indeed on a grand scale, at least so far as the preparations were concerned. An enormous square stage, replete with white mattresses and bolsters, had been erected in the space, once a garden, between the main building and the rear compound wall. This was surmounted by a canopy, at the 4 corners of which hung curtains. so that from a distance the structure had the appearance of a four-poster bed of Brobdingnagian proportions. On the ground in front of the stage were row upon row of white mattresses. Strings of fairy lights hung between the buildings and from branch to branch of the giant flame of the forest trees. Yet despite the elaborate preparations, the meeting was poorly attended. It must have been a long time since Gunzarinal Nanda, a wiry, Gandhi-capped figure with a black walrus moustache and a surprisingly bass voice, had addressed so small an audience. Even I usually had a bigger one. But though there could not have been more than 70 people down there in front of us on the white mattresses, the Union Minister for Planning made a cheerful speech, in which he eulogised Dr. Mehta and the society in very general terms, while I, for my part, spoke of the need for a sense of direction in life. People might talk about ideals, I declared, but a man could know what his ideal was only when he knew himself. Human beings lived on two levels, the animal and the rational, between which they oscillated. But beyond the rational mind there was the level of the superconscious, and beyond that, the transcendental or divine. The aim and object of human life was to live at those higher levels, which were attainable through the practice of concentration and meditation. Those attending the present inaugural meeting would, I hoped, feel that they had been shown the way to a higher life. In the evening there was a concert, the principal performer being a professional singer of devotional songs, who, accompanied by her mother, had travelled from Ahmedabad for the occasion. Madhu Ribben, as she was called, had a dark, pock-marked face and a pair of brilliant black eyes, and must have been in her middle or late 30s. In her green silk sari and with flowers in her sleek black hair, she presented a distinctly queenly appearance as she sat facing the audience that had gathered in the flagstoned hall beneath the gently whirring ceiling fans. Her face, especially when she was singing, wore a kind of triumphant smile, such as one saw on the faces of certain gods and goddesses in ancient Hindu temples. She sang, accompanying herself, with a sort of sistrum, as well as on a stringed instrument of a type with which I was unfamiliar, but which was not a sitar. And from the first notes that the strong, rich voice plucked so confidently out of the air, it was evident that Madhu Ribben was a perfect mistress of her art. Song after devotional song she sang, with a vitality and an intensity of expression that raised the emotional temperature of the crowded hall by several degrees, and no doubt brought some of her auditors nearer to a higher level of consciousness than I had been able to bring them with my presidential address. Though I had been privileged to hear some fine renderings of devotional songs by singers both professional and non-professional, the present performance was of an entirely different order, and I could well understand why the saints and sages of the Hindu Bhakti tradition should have come to regard sacred music as constituting an independent path to the realization of the divine. The Pune branch of the Society of Servants of God having been duly inaugurated, and the stage dismantled and taken away, the Nature Cure Clinic was a very quiet place. Besides Dr. Mehta, Sundri and Hira, the only persons left in the main building were me and Parvati, a middle-aged woman with permed white hair, dark glasses, and an exaggeratedly English accent, who was, it seemed, still under Dr. Mehta's care and semi-convalescent. Dr. Mehta was staying on in Pune because he had received guidance to this effect in meditation, and I was staying on because Dr. Mehta had invited me to do so, though whether the invitation came from him or from God through him was unclear. Whichever may have been the case, I was glad to be there. Pune was very pleasant in winter. It was cooler than Bombay and much less humid. And despite the blue skies and brilliant sunshine, the heat was not oppressive. In subsequent years, Pune was to become one of my favourite places in India and one of the principal centres of my activities. On this first visit, however, I saw nothing of the city proper, being content to enjoy the peace and quiet of the Nature Cure Clinic, a peace and quiet broken only by the sound of the occasional train and the high-pitched, incessant note of the brain fever bird, as well as to join the rest of our little community in the daily routine that had soon been established. There was a group meditation in Dr. Mehta's room early in the morning, while it was still dark, followed by a second one after breakfast, and a third in the evening. In between I read, talked with Dr. Mehta, and took a constitutional stroll along the weed-grown paths that bordered what had once been the garden. Meals were taken out of doors in the courtyard of Bapu Cottage, at a table set beneath one of the giant flame-of-the-forest trees. Thus the days and weeks passed. It was an idyllic existence, such as would not have been possible in strife-torn Bombay, which had been the scene, shortly before my departure, of serious disturbances in connection with the demand by the Marathi-speaking section of the population for a separate Maharashtra state with Bombay as its capital. Rask and I had happened to be in town at the time of the worst of these disturbances, when the police opened fire on a group of demonstrators at Flora Fountain in the heart of the fort area, killing 6 people and injuring many others. In a letter to Dinu, written in the 4th or 5th week of my stay at the Nature Cure Clinic, I gave my new friend a glimpse of what life was like there at the time. Though she was, I knew, eager to know how I was getting on at the place, it was not possible for me to satisfy her curiosity in a letter, or even in many letters. Having apologised for not writing earlier, and expressed the hope that we might meet in Bombay before she left for her pilgrimage to Ceylon and Japan, I therefore proceeded to give her more news of common friends than of myself. Extract from letter. Doctor is keeping quite well, I wrote. He has been reading several extracts from Buddhist books and repeatedly refers to the Buddha's life and teachings. He's even thinking of making a small Buddhist shrine here. Gulben is quite cheerful and, of course, as active as usual. She and I have become well acquainted, and she too likes to hear about Buddhism. We chant the Buddhist prayers or verses from the Dhammapada every day together before meditation. You would like it. Mrs. Rashna Mistry is coming every day. She too is very Buddhist-minded. Sundri and Hira are as busy as ever and bear the main brunt of the work. Probably you have heard that the Society will be publishing a journal called Living Silence, and that Hira will be the publisher, Sundri editor, and myself associate editor. Parvati has not been keeping well and has been confined to her bed for several days. On the whole, the atmosphere here is very good, with everybody friendly and cheerful. End of extract. One of the reasons Dr. Mehta was keeping quite well was, probably, that he had taken to joining me on my constitutional stroll around the garden, instead of remaining indoors on his gaddi all day, as was his custom in Bombay. At the time of my arrival at the clinic, Gulben, his wife, had been not at all cheerful. The fact that her long-absent husband had chosen to stay in the main building with his disciples, rather than at Bapu Cottage with her and the children, had hurt her deeply, and initially she had refused to have anything to do with the inauguration of the Society's Pune branch. Friends had interposed, however, and eventually she was persuaded to attend the evening concert. By the time I wrote to Dinu, she had more or less adjusted to the situation, and as mentioned in my letter, she and I had become well acquainted. At first, thinking I was a disciple, she had been a little wary of me, but on learning that this was not the case, and that I no more believed that the scripts came from God than she did herself, her attitude had changed. Like Dr. Mehta, she was a Parsi, and like him she wore kadi, the coarse cotton hand loom cloth that was the mark of the Gandhian true believer, and which took, in her case, the form of a baggy Gujarati-style sari that was really much too thick and heavy for such warm weather. Unlike her husband, however, Gulben was a follower of the way of Martha rather than of the way of Mary, being no less convinced of the importance of good works than he was of the value of meditation. She indeed was a kind, open-hearted woman with a quite exceptional willingness to be of service to others. Though Gulben attended the group meditations, she always left straight afterwards, so that my principal contact with her was at mealtimes. These were pleasant, sociable occasions over which Dr. Mehta presided in patriarchal fashion, with his wife at his elbow and his servants in attendance. In the days when the Nature Cure Clinic and Sanatorium was a thriving institution, and he one of Pune's and Bombay's best-known physicians, he and Gulben had, it seemed, kept open house, and even now old friends and ex-patients would drop in at mealtimes and be invited to join us at the big round table. Sometimes Dr. Mehta afterwards told me their histories. Many of them, like the Buddhist-minded Mrs. Rashna Mistry, mentioned in my letter to Dinu, were Parsis, and many, I noticed, were more than a little perplexed by the host's transition from naturopath to divinely guided guru, and unsure how to relate to him in his new capacity. One who was not at all perplexed was Mr. Bow, as everyone called him, a lean, hatchet-faced, jovial Italian who had been interned at Dehradun with Lama Govinda, and who, after the war, had settled in Pune and made a living for himself as general handyman and amateur inventor. Mr. Bow was not perplexed because he did not believe in God, and could therefore cheerfully dismiss Dr. Mehta's claims to divine guidance and continue to treat him as he always had done. He was, in fact, a militant atheist, an ardent socialist, and a sworn enemy of the Roman Catholic Church, with an inexhaustible fund of stories and jokes that were very much at the expense of popes, cardinals, bishops, priests, and the whole clerical fraternity. Some of his stories and jokes were extremely funny, and Mr. Bow's comically fractured English and expressive gestures ensured that they lost nothing in the telling. Dr. Mehta did not much relish these jeux d'esprit, though Gulben and I enjoyed them immensely, nor did he really like being treated as though he was still just the eminent naturopath, and not, as he believed himself now to be, the recipient of God's guidance to the society, India, and the world. Sometimes he tried to bring God into the conversation and assert his own new character. But with Gulben there to remind him of the past, this was not always easy, especially when she produced, as she did on one occasion, photographs of the famous Greek statue posing performances he had given 30 years previously, when he was not only mad about bodybuilding, but a thoroughgoing agnostic. These trials, the servant of servants, bore with reasonable good humour, secure in the conviction that, as he used to tell me afterwards, a prophet had no honour in his own country, or at least in his own house, and that this was proof positive of his being a prophet. Once he confided to me that he was sure the Buddha must have had difficulties with Yashodhara, even though there was no mention of this in the Buddhist scriptures. Our more serious discussions usually took place after the second meditation, or when we were strolling round the garden later in the day. As Gulben was in the kitchen of Bapu Cottage, Sundri often away in Bombay on quality control business, and Hira out running errands in the bazaar, we were usually undisturbed. Though Dr. Mehta did, no doubt, repeatedly refer to the Buddha and his teachings, more often than not in an attempt to discover parallels with his own experiences, our discussions covered a good deal of ground, from nature cure to the ethics of hunting — he confessed to having been a great shikari in his time — and from Indian politics to the moral rearmament movement. He had known Dr. Frank Bushman. As a result of these discussions, we became better acquainted, and I could not but acknowledge that while Dr. Mehta's manner could be a trifle portentous, there was a simple human side to his character, and that whatever reservations I might have about the nature of the guidance he received, he was, in fact, undoubtedly a man of broad sympathies, deep understanding, and great personal integrity. One day he told me the story of his conversion from agnosticism to a life of God-guidedness. Towards the end of what was to have been a fast to death, he heard a voice. The voice told him to terminate the fast, which he had undertaken because he was at the end of his tether intellectually, and to terminate it on its 50th day. Many more such spiritual experiences followed, but on account of his agnostic convictions, he was unable to accept them. The inner struggle had lasted 17 years. In the end, he had asked for a sign, and a sign had been given him, and thereafter he had accepted to follow the guidance vouchsafed him, by God, as he believed, when he was in a state of deep meditation. That was just over 2 years ago. Since then, his whole life had gradually changed. He had founded the Society of Servants of God, and now all his activities were based on the guidance he received in meditation, as the activities of the Society also were. Meditation and the acceptance of the guidance received in meditation indeed formed the principal themes of Dr. Mehta's teachings. With much of what he said about meditation, I was in complete agreement, especially as it was evident that he spoke more from personal experience than from books. Guidance was another matter, though the actual content of the guidance received might be acceptable. It was acceptable, so far as I was concerned, only because it was in agreement with my own reason and experience and with the Buddha's teaching, not because it was said to come from God. And of course, sometimes that content was unacceptable. Dr. Mehta himself was inclined to see any refusal to accept guidance, that is, the guidance that came for one through him, as being simply a matter of the ego's resistance to divine grace. But as I pointed out, the fact that one did not follow the guidance that came through him did not necessarily mean that one's life was unguided. Take my own case. I was a Buddhist. I followed the guidance given by the Buddha in the Buddhist scriptures and felt no need to look for guidance elsewhere. Rather grudgingly, Dr. Mehta admitted that it was possible to be guided in this general way, though he added that such guidance was much less reliable than that which came for one through a God-guided personality with which one was in actual contact. The most reliable kind of guidance was, of course, that which came to one directly from God when one was in a state of deep meditation, which was the way his guidance came to him. But the vast majority of people were incapable of reaching such a state, and their guidance had, therefore, to come to them indirectly. Those who were not God-guided had to submit themselves unconditionally to the guidance of those who were. This was one of the great laws of spiritual life. The upshot of this exchange, and others like it, was that during the second half, especially of my stay at the Nature Cure Clinic, I made a special effort to deepen my meditation. Though I had been meditating for a number of years, my achievements in this field were far from commensurate with my aspirations. There were experiences of the bliss and peace of the lower dhyanas. There were visions, usually of the Buddha or Avalokiteshvara. There were flashes of insight, not always in connection with the meditation itself. And that was about all. What I now had to do, I felt, was to achieve a level of meditative experience which would enable me to receive whatever might be the Buddhist equivalent of Dr. Mehta's guidance. For much as I rejected the possibility of guidance by God, a being in whose existence I did not believe, I was well aware that for real spiritual progress to take place, the ego, or defiled mind consciousness, as the Yogacara termed it, needed to open itself to the influence of what I was later to call the transcendental outpourings of the Absolute. Just how that deeper or higher level was to be achieved was not clear, but I trusted that if I was able to stay long enough in the lower dhyanas, the inherent momentum of those states, together with my intense desire to be truly guided, would be sufficient to carry me further. Conditions were favourable. The Nature Cure Clinic was quiet and peaceful. I was meditating three times a day with a small group of spiritually minded people, at least one of whom appeared to have an extensive acquaintance with meditative states, and I had no worries about my livelihood. In order to be able to review my daily and weekly progress, or otherwise, I started keeping a meditation diary. I had kept one once before during my wandering days, but after 2 years it was so bulky that I discontinued it and eventually burned it. The present diary, which I kept from the morning of the 1st of February to the evening of the 7th of March, was a much less weighty affair. The entries were no more than rough notes meant for my own eyes, but even so, like dried flowers long pressed within the pages of a book, they had the power to evoke in after years a sense of the experiences of which they were mementos. Though progress during those 5 weeks was by no means uniform, there were occasions when my concentration was poor, overall I succeeded in achieving higher states of consciousness than usual and staying in them longer. Often I experienced what I described in my diary as positive peace, by which I meant a peace that was not merely an absence of conflict, but which had a definite nature of its own, cool, refreshing, and vibrant. Sometimes this peace came percolating into my consciousness from a level even higher than the one I had attained, like water trickling down through the soil. At other times it was felt in the body. On the evening of the 7th of February, for example, as my diary records, concentrated quite easily, neither quite in nor quite out of ordinary mind, experience of positive peace in crown of head. This descended and spread throughout whole body, experience of ascending and descending at same time. All kinds of movements and explosions of energy in the body, though not exactly in the physical body. As though some healing, at the same time destructive, force was pulling and stretching and kneading the mind. Dr. Mehta explained when I told him about these experiences that there was a conflict between grace descending through the topmost chakra and effort ascending through the lower chakras, the point of meeting being at the third or navel chakra. It may have seemed so, but nevertheless I did not find the explanation entirely satisfactory, especially as I tended, in any case, to be wary of employing the language of chakras and kundalini. To me, such language, together with its underlying philosophy, smacked not so much of Buddhism as of Hinduism. Be that as it may, besides positive peace, I also experienced feelings of intense love and devotion towards the Buddha, especially in the form of Amitabha and Avalokiteshvara, which was not often the case with me. Sometimes these feelings were accompanied by the corresponding visionary experiences, but more often there would be an awareness of the transcendental, quote, person, unquote, in question, without my being conscious of any particular form. On several occasions, this awareness was so strong that I was able to put questions and receive answers. Not that I heard any words, whether my own or the Buddha's. I pronounced the words of my questions subvocally, and those of the Buddha's answers were imprinted directly on my consciousness, without being pronounced at all. The first such experience occurred on the morning of the 11th of February, the diary entry for which reads, concentrated, feeling of total dissociation between past and present life. Doubt. Awareness of answer, whatever leads to, etc., is my Dharma. Decided to ask more questions as follows. Question. What should be my attitude towards surroundings after returning to K? Answer. Absolute detachment. This detachment is positive. must be detached even from the Buddha. Detachment, as taught by the Buddha, transcends both attachment and detachment in the ordinary sense. Question: how behave towards people? Answer: Buddha first and everyone else second. Awareness of shortcomings in this respect. Question: what about acquiring land, etc.? Answer: this will be settled after your return. You must be ready to be anywhere and nowhere. Awareness of the Buddha's presence, though rather faintly, in brackets, SIC. Reflected whether these awarenesses were genuine guidance. Concluded that, since they were in agreement with the scriptures and were not unreasonable, they could be accepted. The diary entry for the evening of the following day, the 12th of February, records a similar experience. Good concentration. Sensation of positive peace descending. Asked, what should I do? Awareness of answer came at once, nothing. Experience of emptiness and stillness. Self reduced to an absolute pinpoint. This state lasted for some time. Awareness, whatever works you may have to do later on, in the midst of them, you'll have to maintain this state of mind. Experiences on subsequent days included visions of flowers made as though of flame, and of jewels of intense light. Sensations as of a light trying to break through, as well as of vastness and emptiness, and an awareness of the importance and meaning of the White Lotus Sutra. My predominant experience, however, especially during the second half of the month, was one of increasingly intense feelings of love and devotion towards the Buddha and Avalokiteshvara. On one occasion, I felt in the region of the heart a love and peace so strong that I was unable to bear it and had to stop meditating for a while. There was also a sensation as of someone touching me on the heart, and an experience of my heart chakra being suddenly opened. During this period, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, featured no less prominently in my experience than did the Buddha, and it was not without significance that his name should be mentioned in my last diary entry for the evening of the 7th of March, which ran, fairly good concentration, feeling of devotion, awareness of universe as it appears in the eyes of Avalokiteshvara. Again, feeling of devotion. Consciousness of peace descending from a great height. More often than not, I discussed my experiences with Dr. Mehta, and sometimes he told me about his own. One morning he had a vision of three monks meditating under the influence of the Buddha, which was probably indicative of his growing interest in Buddhism. But though we spent much of our time discussing meditation, and though meditation and the acceptance of the guidance received in meditation formed the principal themes of his teaching, the servant of servants life had not changed so much since his conversion that he had forgotten the secular and humanist ideals of his unguided days. Whether owing to his Parsi family background or his Gandhian associations, he still had an active social conscience. He continued, for instance, to be strongly opposed to the caste system, especially to its most abhorrent manifestation, the practice of untouchability. His opposition was not only theoretical but practical. As I had soon discovered, the servants at the Nature Cure Clinic, who had been with him and Gulben for decades, were Marathi-speaking members of the scheduled castes, and therefore potential converts to Buddhism. Perhaps they would know whereabouts in Pune the Buddhists with whom I wanted to make contact lived. In the event they did not know, any more than did Mrs. Mystery or Mr. Bow or any of the other visitors I questioned on the subject, and I began to think that the inverted commas considerable number of Pune Buddhists of whom I had heard in Bombay had a purely mythical existence. Dr. Mehta was of the same opinion. At least, during all his years in Pune, he had not come across a single Buddhist. He did, however, believe that conversion to Buddhism would be very much to the advantage of the scheduled caste's people, When I told him about my meeting with Dr. Ambedkar, he at once suggested I should write to the scheduled caste leader, inviting him and Mrs. Ambedkar to spend a few days at the Nature Cure Clinic and continue our discussions there. The place being a nursing home, whatever medical facilities he might require would be available. Whether because he could not spare the time or because the institution's Gandhian associations did not appeal to him, he and Gandhi had been political opponents. Dr. Ambedkar did not take up the invitation, and when we did meet, 10 or more months later, it was in a different place and under very different circumstances. End of chapter 20.